And the reading is from Genesis chapter 32. It's not actually part of a series, although it's part of the Jacob cycle of stories. So for those who are coming on church weekend, it's a little bit of a backdrop to the story of Joseph, who of course was one of the sons of Jacob. So here's one of the perhaps stranger stories of Jacob's life. Genesis 32, beginning at verse 22. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and everything else that he had. I think I got the emphasis wrong there. He took them and sent them across the stream, and everything else that he had. And Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then the man said, "Let me go, for the day has broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then the man said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. This is the word of the Lord. I once saw an Englishman defined as a self-made man who worships his creator. You have to think about that a bit. A self-made man who worships his creator. Who's he worshiping? Very good. Well done. I'm not actually sure it's entirely fair to suggest that only the people of my race fall into that particular danger. Perhaps it's that sense of effortless superiority seeping from every pore that means we give the impression of being self-made men. But I think it's often true of other nations as well, although they're often not quite so well-made as we are, of course. Well, it was certainly true of Jacob, the man who famously here wrestles with God. He was a man on the make, and he stopped at nothing to gain advantage for himself. He allowed nothing and no one to get in the way of furthering his own ambitions. He consistently put himself first. He created his own fortune, and he created it by fair means or foul, as we say in English. And for much of his life, he was actually a thoroughly unpleasant character. And then comes this rather strange incident on the banks of the river Jabbok, which sounds as if it's something from Lewis Carroll's fantasy poems, like the Jabberwocky. And at the first reading, it raises as many questions as it answers. And let me tell you, by the 10th reading, not a lot has changed. But the thing that has helped me most has been to see this incident in the light of the rest of Jacob's life. If you like to view this particular incident in terms of the overall trajectory of where he'd come from and where he was heading. And that gives us the structure for this evening's sermon. We're going to talk about the story so far, that is the story of Jacob so far, the story here in this incident, and the story from here on in his life. So the story so far, it begins even before he is born, back in chapter 25. Many of you will know that Jacob was not alone in the womb. He had a twin brother. And even at that stage, they weren't exactly the best of pals. 25:22. The children struggled together within Rebekah. And she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" And went to inquire of the Lord. So she feels a struggle going on, even in the womb. And then the Lord answers to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. One shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." No points for guessing which the younger one is. Jacob, in the normal run of things, he would have served his older brother, Esau. But not in this case. And when her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak. So they named him Esau. And afterwards his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, Bephersa. So his name was called Jacob. And if you look at the footnote, you'll see that Jacob can mean two things. It means to grasp the heel literally, but it was actually an idiom in Hebrew meaning to deceive. If you grasp someone's heel, you were deceiving. So his very name is ambiguous. It implies cheating and deceitfulness. And he soon proves himself worthy of the name. Verse 29, once when Jacob was cooking stew, he was always mummy's girl in the kitchen, mummy's boy in the kitchen, Esau came in from the field because he was daddy's boy and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Oh, let me eat some of that red stew for I'm exhausted." And Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear it to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. We won't go into all the issues of quite what the birthright was and all that sort of thing. But you may have heard the expression, he sold his birthright for a mess of pottage, which is the old English in the Authorized Version for the stew, the casserole, a mess of pottage. Jacob manipulated, he exploited the weakness of his brother to get his own advantage. And he does it again when his father Isaac is old and frail and half blind. He pretends to be Esau. He gets his confused father to give him the blessing which should have gone to the firstborn. That's 27 verse 28. May God, this is Isaac to Jacob, may God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you. So he deceives his father by pretending to be Esau and various things. It's a good story. Do read it. And you see that he's living up to his name of the deceiver, der Betrüger. So you can see why I've given as the first subheading under the story so far, blessing grasped. That's putting it mildly. He manipulates those around him to get what he wants. But there are some repercussions, some consequences. Esau is not amused. He indeed goes as far as issuing a death threat. says in the text he says to himself, but it sounds as if he said it in the hearing of others, and Jacob is warned, your brother wants to kill you, and so he needs to flee. And as he flees, he has the first of several significant dreams which occur to Jacob. So if you think of Joseph as the man with the many dreams, well, he got it from his father, this gift, to some extent. And he dreams, when he's sleeping out in the open, of a ladder, a lighter, going up from where his head is up to heaven. And he hears this voice. We're at 28:13. The Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you are lying, I will give to you and to your offspring, your nachkoma. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So as he's about to leave the promised land for his own safety, he hears that promise of coming back one day. And if you were doing a sort of ranking of undeserved promises throughout history, this would rank pretty high up amongst the undeserved promises. The deceiver is determined to make his own fortune, but God still insists on blessing him. So that explains the second subheading, blessing promised. But even after this generous promise, listen carefully to the vow he makes, Jacob makes, in the light of that promise. And this is verse 20. If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then, if all those conditions are fulfilled, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth back to you. He's not taking anything for granted, this Jacob. If God keeps his side of the bargain, Jacob might keep his vow. So he has to be really certain before he trusts anyone, even God himself. Blessing promised then, and my third subheading under the story so far is this, blessing experienced. It's a long story, and I'll just summarize what then happens as he leaves the territory of Canaan, the promised land. He travels east, and he manages to find a relative of his father's, well, his own relative too, Laban. And he manages to, Laban takes him in and gives him work. Jacob works for 7 years to win the hand of the beautiful younger daughter in marriage. But for once in his life, Jacob the deceiver is deceived. And he wakes up on his wedding morning and he finds the woman he took as his wife is actually the not so pretty older daughter. So he then gets the other daughter, Rachel, fairly straight away, but he has to work. It's like on credit. He has to work another 7 years for Laban, to work off the debt, if you like, for this second daughter. He has 12 sons in total, but as you saw earlier, only 11 have been born so far by these two wives and also by each of their maidservants. And alongside the breeding program, he manages pretty well in business, farming, naturally, in those days. Laban gives him his start with a few animals to start things going. And again, by fair means, as well as by foul means, he steadily builds up his own flocks. And surprise, surprise, he ends up with bigger flocks and a wealthier man than Laban himself. Though to be fair, as this was happening, Laban was continuing to try to deceive Jacob. So in one sense, Jacob just proved to be the better cheat And so it is that the promise in Isaac's father blessing to him is fulfilled. May God give you of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. He is experiencing the blessings, but a lot of it's happening through his own grasping and deceiving. Well, in the end, the old cliche proves true. I can't remember who said it. I think it was a cowboy. This town's too small for both of us. Anyone tell me who said that? No? I thought it was a famous cowboy spruch, but I look at the film expert, Jacob, who's seen most films that Hollywood's produced, and he doesn't know, so it may not be as famous as I thought it was. A lot of people say it. Okay. Anyone who wants to be tough says it. They don't actually say it to them to each other, but it proves true that the Lord basically tells Jacob it's time to move on. And I must have written the wrong reference there. It's not 21:13. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this place and return to the land of your kindred. That's the 31:13. That sounds a great idea, I guess. He'd made his money. He'd made an enemy of Laban along the way, pretty much. And not a bad idea to get back. But there's one snag, and it's called Esau. How's he going to feel about seeing his twin brother again? Is he going to be rolling out the red carpet, or is he going to be still breathing murderous intent? And as you see from the heading in ESV, in this version, when you get to chapter 32, the heading is Jacob Fears Esau. And so that brings us up to date to our second main heading, the story here. And the strangeness of the story isn't limited to the second half of the chapter, that wrestling match. It begins in the first two verses. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." And so he called the name of that place Mahanaim, which means two camps, or dual camps. The angels were not, they're not mentioned again. We don't hear anything more about this incident except that he sees them. So it does rather leave us scratching our heads. What are we supposed to make of that? It's not the first time that Jacob has seen an angel or angels. That there was that dream at Bethel with the ladder going up to heaven and there were angels going up and down. Sorry, it may have been a staircase. I can't remember if it was ladder or staircase. There's the dream when God had told him it's time now to head home. That was given through an angel. And now here he is on his way back, about to cross back into the promised land, and the angels appear. So it is interesting, they appear at key points on the journey. As he crosses the border, leaving the promised land, he sees the angels. And the point furthest away, just before he turns, he sees angels. As he re-enters the promised land, he sees the angel. It certainly shows that he is a man who has the gift of seeing into spiritual realms, whether that was an inborn gift or a gift that had been given him for particular occasions. But if you take two of the main things we find angels doing in the scriptures, they're God's messengers, and we found that in one case here, that they pass on a message to him. But they're also God's agents. You could say they're God's soldiers, his infantry. And it seems likely that both of those roles are involved here. They're messengers giving directions, and they're infantry soldiers guarding him on the way as he goes out and he comes back in. He certainly needs the reassurance. He sends his own messengers ahead to Esau. And they come back with an ambiguous answer. It's unclear if they've actually spoken to Esau or not. But they return saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you. And there are 400 men with him." Doesn't sound too promising. Could be a very, very large welcoming party. but it sounds rather more like a small army. Well, Jacob has a plan up his sleeve. He always has a plan up his sleeve, but he knows it's not the greatest of plans. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two camps, thinking, if Esau comes to one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape. So he's willing to take a 50% loss in the hope of escaping with the others. But he is afraid, we're told. Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He needs reassurance, and perhaps the appearance of the angels is something to do with assuring him that God is still with him, watching over him by the angels. However good that plan may have been, and no doubt he didn't think it was that great, he does seem to realize that this thing's got too big, even for him to handle. So I think it's for the first time that is recorded, we hear Jacob praying. For a man who was self-made and did it all by his own efforts, that's quite a significant change. So that's why the first subheading under this point is blessing requested. And there's a tone about his prayer, a mood about it that we haven't heard before. There's humility, demut, and awareness of the grace he's already received. Verse 10, I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. He acknowledges that it's not entirely his own doing that he has prospered while he's been away from the promised land. God had his hand in there, he acknowledges. And there's humility as he acknowledges his need and requests help. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother. And the whole prayer is actually on the basis of the instructions God has given. He's fitting in with what God said, verse 9. O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred that I may do you good. So if you like, he's reminding God of the instruction which he's following. And then at the end, he reminds him of the promise. But you said, I will surely do you good and make you your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So he's praying on the basis of what God has already said, always a very good basis for prayer. Something has shifted in Jacob. He's no longer just relying on his own native wit, and he's speaking in a humbler way than we've heard before. And so we come to our passage, and I give this the subheading, Blessing Demanded. Again, there are lots of unanswered questions. Even the commentaries give up speculating quite what everything in this incident means. Here's what we do know. Jacob doesn't start the fight. A man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day, implies that it was started by the other. Jacob doesn't win the fight, but he does quite well, because, if you like, the opponent is forced to use special measures, measures that probably weren't in the wrestling rule book. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint. I guess that probably means it was dislocated, we say, in English. Jacob doesn't realize who he is fighting with to start with, but there seems to be a dawning awareness of who it is as it continues. He clings to this man. He's never one to give up easily. But dawn is approaching, and that makes this opponent uneasy for some reason. It suggested maybe if this was an incarnation of God himself, maybe there was danger for Jacob if he actually did see this opponent in broad daylight rather than in the night. Jacob sets a condition, a bedingung, for letting go. The tradition was the stronger person blesses the weaker person. So he's admitting that he's lost when he demands a blessing, but he's determined he won't go away empty-handed. I will not let you go unless you bless me. Then the opponent does something significant. He gives Jacob a new name, from Jacob to Israel, from deceiver to striver, streber. Although I don't think it has the sort of connotations. I think in German, streber means someone who's trying a bit too hard, a goody-goody in English. And that prompts Jacob to ask the man what his name is. Perhaps he's now suspecting who this is. And he doesn't get his question answered, but he does get his request granted. Verse 29, Jacob asked, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. And so that gives us our third subheading, blessing received. Jacob's suspicions have been confirmed. He now realizes who it was. And he called the name of the place Peniel, which means face to face, or the face of God. For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. And Jacob limps off into the sunset. Oh, sorry, into the sunrise. The opposite of the cowboy films, where the lone hero limps off into the sunset. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. Blessing has been received, and we see it working out in the next chapter, or the next chapters. But we mustn't miss the great irony here. Jacob has struggled half his life to get hold of blessings, and God was intending to give them to him anyway. Part of it was there in the promise before he was born. Part of it's there in Isaac's blessing of him. Partly it's in the blessing that was given him when he was resting at Bethel, when he saw that dream. God has consistently promised that he will bless him. But it's almost as if Jacob has never trusted that promise and said, no, I'm going to get hold of those blessings. I'm going to grasp them for myself by my own efforts. Not that it is totally wrong to say that we have to take action sometime to enter into the blessings that God is providing. God doesn't expect us to sit around and just wait for the blessings to fall into our lap. He expects us to take action to, if you like, activate those blessings. But we're not to do it in the sense that Jacob did. We don't get to enjoy God's blessings by desperately trying to manufacture our own good fortune. And we don't get to enjoy God's blessings by manipulating people and situations, or even trying to manipulate God himself. That is not the way to get hold of the blessings God has promised. But by this stage, Jacob has learned to trust in God, and he's beginning to learn not to trust in his own abilities. And it was a long, slow process, and a painful one at times. It required him leaving his home country and fleeing. That was part of God teaching him. And in this wrestling, we see this idea of the wrenched hip as a mark of the pain that is involved when we struggle with God. And God, if you like, struggles with us to make us let go of manipulation and manufacturing our own blessings and trust him for them. And so we come to the last heading, the story so far, the story here in this incident, and the story from here on. And don't worry, I'm not going to go into it in detail. But here's another question I'd like answered. Did he always limp? What's limp? Humpeln, is it? From this point on? I always thought that was what the passage said, but when I look more closely, it doesn't actually say that. It leaves us to wonder whether at some point in the next few weeks it healed or not. I like to think he did continue to limp the rest of his life as a continuing sign, as a reminder of this key lesson that he's learned here, because he's a changed man from now on. And that change is expressed in the new name. No longer Jacob, but Israel. No longer the deceiver, but the striver. Or the struggler. Here are two things which are different about him now. He knows his limits. There are certain things that are beyond him, beyond even his manipulative skills. One of those limits is that he can't dig himself out of the hole that he's dug with his brother Esau. It's entirely his fault, that problem with Esau. It sprang from his own deceitfulness, his arglist or betrügerei, whatever you want to call it, falschheit. Someone disobeyed Axel's instruction. Axel will see that person afterwards. God has forced him into this situation where he comes up against his limits. God has put him in the situation where he realizes his limits. He doesn't just learn that he has limits, he learns that God has no limits. And that's a pretty important lesson for any of us to learn. Sometimes God has to put us in really quite tough situations before we're brought to an end of self and to a beginning of really trusting in him. Or it's a progress thing. He brings us to a deeper stage of trusting. Perhaps we're already trusting a bit, but not enough. And he puts us in the situation where we really come to the end of our tether, come to our limits. And all we can do is trust. And God is using that to train us and transform us, as he's doing here. Maybe it will involve struggle before we are willing to let go and really trust him. Because it's scary sometimes, letting go of the ways of operating we've got used to, the ways of behaving we're used to, the ways of doing things ourselves that we're used to, which are keeping us from trusting in him. So Jacob knows his limits, and secondly, he knows his place. It's not for him to try to do God's work for him. From now on, he will lean less on his own ability and more on God's ability. Instead of depending on himself, he'll depend on God in his dependability. One of the commentators has this comment on those words, those famous words in verse 26, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." He asks the question, are these words that God has waited 40 years to hear the answer to? Is there a sense in which from the very beginning, God has been working in Jacob's life to this point where Jacob is forced to say, I desperately need you to bless me. I know my place. I know that I'm not God. And I know that I need God. So it's been a journey from the self-made man to what you might call the God-shaped or the God-formed man. From manipulation to trust. If you like, from manufacturing his own gluck to depending on God to give him things. A journey from self-made man to God-shaped man. And I would suggest that's actually a journey that each of us is on in one way or another, not just those of us who live across the channel. Often it is well disguised. We can make our self-madeness even sound quite pious, quite fromm, by dressing it up in certain words. And sometimes God has to use special measures to get us to where we need to be. It's unlikely any of us will quite have this experience of wrestling with a figure who turns out to be God himself, if you like, a pre-incarnate or a pre-incarnation incarnation of Jesus. But it may be that he uses painful measures, circumstances, people, situations, and so on, special measures to bring us to an end of self and to a deeper level of trusting in him. And as I close, let me just remind you of that reading from John 15, because I think it's the same basic idea that you find in the parable of the vine and the vine dresser. Remember the idea of pruning. I am the true vine, my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch of mine that does not bear fruit, he takes away. That's a warning. Actually, a warning to those who are not believers in Jesus, that there is a judgment to be faced. But if those who are believers in Jesus, he's not promising a particularly easy life. Listen to what he says. Every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes. I think that's beschneiden. That it may bear more fruit. In other words, he puts that branch in a situation where it has to go through a painful experience so that it can be more fruitful in the future. It's the same aim and the same outcome. And it's all about depending as well. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. Well, I guess Jacob could have said, well, I achieved quite a lot without you, God. But actually, he'd come to realize that even those things that he'd grasped were actually things that God had been giving him. And secondly, he had learned that those weren't the most important things, those things that he'd grasped of himself, that God had far more important things for him, and that perhaps the most important thing he had for him was to teach him to depend and lean on God. So you might say it's better to be on this journey with a limp than to be stuck in a far country. It's better to be on the journey from self-made person to a person reshaped by God than it is to be in a far country, a long way from the source of all blessings. Perhaps during communion, it's a chance to us to reflect on that, a chance to let go if God is showing you anything in your life that you're clinging on to instead of trusting in him. A chance to ask him to shed light into our lives and show us where we might be making the Jacob mistake and need to be moved through this Jacob experience to deeper dependence and trust. Let me pray before we sing. Lord God Almighty, we confess that all of us are at different stages of that journey, from depending on self to depending on you. I'm conscious that each one of us in different ways is holding on to things, is clinging on to self-reliance in different areas of our life and hindering you from blessing us as you want to. We pray that you'd forgive us where we're grasping things in our own strength and failing to trust in you. And we ask that you would do what it takes to move us further on that journey to true dependence on you. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.